Hello and welcome to Pathways, where you are invited to join me for a visit with leaders in personal development and cultural evolution. This is your host, Paul O'Brien. Becoming aware of our motivations and identifying our unique point of view can help us connect to the human spirit as we move through life. By blending philosophy, psychology, and a dab of spirituality, today's guest shows us how we can learn to organize the worlds inside our heads and then live out our creative destinies. The book we're discussing today can be taken as a companion for your journey inward and outward to sharpen your imagination and craft a life of meaning. Our guest today is Robert Stonehill, author of Wise and Shine. Think clearly, live deeply, be someone you value. A theorist, caregiver, and part-time mystic, Robert writes at the intersection of empathy, empowerment, and creative thinking. He has studied academic and traditional wisdom independently for 15 years. Additionally, he has studied in all three divisions of modern academia, the physical sciences at Harvard, the social sciences at Purdue, and humanities at Reed College here in Portland. In early 2014, he began hosting monthly wisdom workshops in Portland, Oregon. Hello, Robert, and welcome to the Pathways program.
Hello, Paul. Thank you for having me.
Let's start with the subtitle of your book. I mean, think clearly is clear enough, but what do you mean by living deeply?
I think that a lot of the loudest cultural voices in America tell us things that aren't exactly true, like make more money or be famous or something like that. And live deeply just means attending to those aspects of your life that are going to be most important. So it's living out your values, for example. In particular, one of the main points of the book is that we find a lot of value in friendships. And that's something that our culture doesn't really do very well. We have romantic relationships and work relationships, but we don't really have a lot of great templates for how to make friends, how to interact with friends, and the kind of deeper friendships that people in perhaps different countries have. So live deeply, it means live out your values, but I think one good idea for a value is to consider more friendships.
But what about Facebook? I mean, people have hundreds of friends, don't they?
Yes, technically. But I think that we all realize that in-person relationships are really vital to our lives. I think it's about 70% of our communication is through body language and tone of voice and our eyes. And you can't look into someone's eyes through Facebook. Well, I guess with Facebook FaceTime you can, but it's always a much deeper activity when you're together with the other person.
You know, it's funny. I took out a domain name once called fakefriendships.com, and the business model was to sell friends to Facebook users who wanted gobs of friends or so-called friends. But it was kind of a joke. It was a satire. But
I think that does bring up. So there's this tying these two ideas together of having more friends and living out our values. One of the things we think in America is always bigger is better and more is better. So you know, the more friends we have or the more followers we have on Facebook, you know, we're succeeding. And that's a very similar mindset to the idea that the more money we get, we're succeeding. Like that's really the point of life, is to, you know, chase after more and more money and, you know, bigger and bigger things. But, you know, we find even in psychology studies nowadays, we find that there's really very little impact on a person's well-being or happiness or the meaning of their life. Once they've been able to take care of the bare necessities of life, there really isn't much impact of money on their spirit.
Now, let's talk about the third aspect of the subtitle of your book. What is the sense behind be someone you value?
So this part of the subtitle is really talking about non-duality. And what I mean by that is how we treat ourselves and how we treat other people. And a lot of times those two things don't match. We treat ourselves well, but perhaps we treat others poorly. But even more common is we treat ourselves poorly, but we're very kind to other people. And so one of the main insights that I try to convey in the book is that you can start from either direction, but if you're kind to other people, you're in effect being kind to yourself. When kindness is offered, kindness is part of what you're attending to. It takes over your own life. So if you're kind to others and you're kind to yourself, they are very interchangeable. So the guide in the book is that if we aren't convinced of that being kind to others is helpful, that we can take it from either of two ways. Basically, that we can be kind to others, and that will actually improve our own lives.
Right. Now, throughout the book, there are pointers to the value of being of service. And this is related to what you're talking about now.
Right.
Why is this theme so important in general to wisdom and empathy, another big theme of the book?
I think that it ties deeply to the kind of ethics that we have in life. And when we're people that have a lot of experience with service really extol the benefits of it. It's really something that is sort of the pinnacle of what we can do in life that's meaningful. We do chase happiness, but if we actually go deeper and think about serving others, our lives actually begin to matter. And that's a deeper importance and meaning that we give to our own lives. By helping others, we value ourselves.
You know, and in the book, when it comes to the development of wisdom, you highlight two kinds of pathways: towards emotional maturity, mm-hmm, or towards spirituality.
Right. So psychology, for the most part, studies emotional maturity and how so there are ideas about emotional differentiation, like can you name all your different emotions, and there's emotional stability, and what we learn through that pathway is the emotional maturity, that something like the road less traveled. Whereas with spirituality, it's a very different pathway. But what we're doing is, instead of feeling our emotions or thinking our thoughts, we're stepping back and observing both of those from some new angle. And a lot of people are able to do that. They don't really think of themselves as spiritual, but it's also sometimes called the meta level, where you can view something from outside of it. So you're viewing your intellect and your thoughts from somewhere outside. And for brevity, we often just call that spirituality. And that place that you're viewing from is incredibly powerful, because it's the seed of the power to change our circumstances. You can't change the intellect and you can't change the emotions when you're just in them.
So that's defining spirituality more as a perspective than as a belief system, as a religion.
Right. So a religion is more intellectual, I would venture. It's often not looked at as perspective. Of course, every religion, just about, I think, has the mystic tradition or the spiritual tradition at the very highest parts, or the secret mysteries or whatnot. And so the religion is is more of a belief system, and that spirituality, you don't have to believe anything to be able to observe your thoughts.
Right, so there's a lot of spiritual people who don't have any, they misunderstand the term, and they would never define themselves as spiritual.
Right.
But they have this ability to witness their thoughts, or an ability to meditate.
Right, it's maybe a new concept in our culture, but I definitely agree that there are, that most people, like a lot of people who are more intellectual perhaps, scoff at spirituality or something like that. But when they realize that it just means the powerful meta level of something, they wholeheartedly agree. So again, it's kind of like a lot of intellectual arguments that where people don't necessarily agree on what the words mean or something, and they get bogged down in these sort of petty arguments. I would guess that most people actually believe in a spirit. They don't necessarily say they're religious, but what is it that gets you up in the morning, for example? What wakes you up? What drives you? What motivates you to do anything? It's your own personal spirit, and you don't need to believe that all the spirits are collected together in some far off land or anything like that. You can make it a very practical part of your life and just realize that that's where your control, that's the locus of your power, is in the observer, the consciousness, because that's where you're able to change your circumstances.
So our source of motivation can come from a higher place than just the ego.
Right.
In fact, when I've tried to define spirituality for friends of mine that are atheists or whatever, and they have an aversion to the term spiritual, I've said, hey, it's just like, you can think of it as a dimension of health. So you have physical health, you have emotional health, you have mental health. What is spiritual health? Well, spiritual health is when your ego is realistically calibrated with all that is. So right. That's a perspective definition.
Right. So you could even say it's sort of your big picture attitude toward life. It's, you can have your intellect and your emotions, but you could be a pessimist, and your life would be far different from someone who had the same intellect and emotions but was an optimist. That extra difference comes from the spirit.
Yeah, and so, this kind of brings us to the subject of wisdom, which you talk about a lot in your book. The first word of the book is wise, wise and shine. And one reader said, the book has practical guided steps for knowing your own mind and purposefully developing wisdom. And to me, it seems like wisdom is going beyond the ego, because if we're stuck in an egocentric approach to everything, where it's about, pleasure versus pain, and there's this polarity, and we're trying to make one half of the polarity win, that we're never going to be very wise. So right. It seems to me wisdom is related to transcending the egocentric point of view. But how would you define wisdom?
Right. Well, wisdom, one of the chapters is completely devoted to transcending apparent opposites. And the conclusion, is that we can sometimes transcend them, but sometimes they're insurmountable. I give the example of belonging versus independence. Those are two things we want. They're at different polarities, but we can never truly surmount them into something. We can't integrate them into something greater. So what we end up doing sometimes is, during our lives, we kind of swing like a pendulum between the polar opposites. The more you understand yourself, of course, the more you're going to understand other people. So we have that non-duality aspect again. But an even more important part of wisdom is the idea of intellectual humility, or epistemic humility, which means we don't have all the answers. And that's something that our ego or the intellect, however you want to call it, doesn't want to hear. The ego wants to have the answer and doesn't really accept the idea of there being any uncertainty or, questions about that. Another idea about wisdom is that it contains multiple perspectives. So this could be different perspectives from different people that you could integrate. It could be different perspectives over time or different roles that we play in society. For example, the child or the parent or the adult. We can play different roles. And these are all kind of meta ideas, and they're also wisdom ideas.
Now, you talk about the wisdom of feeling, you talk about the wisdom of thinking, and you say one of the hallmarks of wisdom is an integration or culling of the information contained in both feeling and thinking.
Right, so there's a psychological idea called dialectical behavioral therapy, and the idea of wisdom in that framework is that it's an integration of your thoughts and your feelings, is what they call wise.
You say it's generally wiser to subtract things from our identity than to add them.
Yes, well, it's often said that learning wisdom is actually unlearning or unbecoming. So we have a lot of conditioning that we've been through in our lives, and a lot of schooling that we could maybe question the value of various aspects of how we school people. And wisdom, in a lot of ways, is kind of going backwards and unlearning a lot of those conditioned responses. And I'm not sure that we can really, you know, be wise as children and go... I'm not sure that we can become adults in any way besides learning and then unlearning. It doesn't seem that we have much of a choice for that. We kind of have to err before we can correct ourselves.
Well, it's because we adopt whatever our parents told us in terms of beliefs and attitudes, and those are bound to be limited
right
by the ignorance of our parents. No offense.
Yes, so it would be very difficult for a child to sort of not be acculturated by anyone.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's so many people that are still cling to the beliefs that they had based on perceptions and conclusions that they came to when they were 4 years old. And they stick with those for their entire life.
Yes.
They're not unlearning.
Right.
And they're not going to develop wisdom.
Well,
to the extent they do that.
So one of the main points of the book isn't really to criticize people, although some people...
Well, that's my job.
Some people have taken the book a little bit, that it was a little bit too critical, but really what we want to do is hold our beliefs a little bit more lightly. And it's not that, you know, everything we do is wrong and we're not being valuable and meaningful in our lives or something like that. The book is meant to help people. And one of the ideas is to consider our beliefs and to just hold them more lightly. They don't have to define who we are. One of the most important things we can say is, I don't know. And, you know, a lot of people go through life without ever saying that.
Right.
So
that's like a mark of shame to say that.
Right.
But, you know, I have a chapter in my book called Belief Engineering, and basically I'm saying, you know, we need to upgrade our beliefs as a result of testing them, questioning them, and trying out new beliefs. And if we still want to own that belief, great, then it's ours. But as long as we adopted it blindly when we were 4 years old,
right, it remains unexamined.
Yeah, it's a self-limiting thing.
I think, going back to an earlier point we talked about, the difference between spirituality maybe and science, a lot of science is based on trial and error. And for some reason, there's this stigma, I guess, around spirituality that it's beyond belief or something, but it's really trial and error. I mean, Buddhism, for example, is very much see how various beliefs, see where they take you, and reassess your beliefs in light of new evidence. It's a very scientific idea system.
Yeah, that makes total sense to me. Well, you do point out in the book that there is not a single road to wisdom, and you're not trying to dictate such. As you say, you must climb your own helix. Our unique and diverse perspectives are the only things that make life interesting.
Right. So I'm a big believer of inclusivity. I don't think that we're all meant to follow the same path. And I think that most people would agree that that would make life pretty boring if people didn't have different opinions about things. But if we're going to live with that idea that people should be different, then we have to hold our beliefs a little bit more lightly. And because we're going, otherwise everything becomes some kind of war or, you know, big argument. But, you know, where it should be, learning about someone else's perspective because they've lived a different life.
Right. And you have some tools in the book, and we don't really have time to go into them in detail. You call them shapes of thought, which are tools to, for better thinking, you know, imaginary shapes.
Mm-hmm.
Can you mention a few of those? And with, I don't want to go into great detail.
Okay, so you mentioned the helix earlier, and that's the idea of overcoming polarities. And so wisdom is very concerned with compromise. So we get a helix shape when we have two polarities, and a compromise creates a triangle. And then as we compromise with more and more polarities as we go on, it slowly becomes a helix or a spring or a coil. Another shape is very popular that has a lot to do with empathy, and it's this idea of concentric circles radiating outward or inward. And this is, you know, who we call our in-group, for example. One major aspect of empathy is increasing our in-group, increasing the size. And so what this would be was increasing the, you know, the circle, the middle of the circle is ourselves. And as we go outward, we get more and more different people. And really, empathy is all about how you relate to people who you don't agree with. So if you already agree with someone and feel for them, you know, maybe they're in your family or a friend, that's not the same as, that's not the real test of empathy is when you encounter someone who disagrees with you and whether or not you can understand and appreciate their perspective.
That is more of a challenge for sure.
Yeah.
And that can require a certain thing called imagination. And you point out in the book that imagination is a primary tool of empathy.
Yes, I do. I do think that, I mean, perhaps the opposite of empathy is projection, and the idea that everyone thinks the same as you do. When you find more and more different people, the further you go out in the circle, you're going to be more tested. And what this really tests is your spirit, but it also tests your ability to imagine different scenarios. So I think developing your imagination is a very important part of developing your empathy, your empathic skills.
Yeah, and you mentioned projection, and the surest antidote to projection is radical listening.
Yes.
What's that?
Well, this is something that Alan Alda brings up in his latest book, and it's this idea that conversation should be like improv. So when you're listening to someone else speak, you're not waiting for your own turn to speak. You're actually listening to what they're saying, and whatever they say determines what you say next. So it's every action then in the conversation is determined by how it's going. So you're not talking from scripts or whatever you plan in your head to say. You have to be more on your feet and like an improv team would be.
You know, I love what you say about spiritual practice, and you call it ego decentering. And you mention Eckhart Tolle's work, mm-hmm. That the ego is never satisfied because it's seeking completion in the future.
Right.
So this has a lot of relationship with empathy and with wisdom and with humility.
Right. So one of the main points of the book is to compare all these different developmental theories and to show how they're similar and how they're different. And the expanding onion or concentric circles that talk about empathy, we can also think of it the opposite direction, the same shape, but moving inward or upward. And this would be like Eckhart Tolle is talking about spirituality, where we cast off the things that we don't identify with. And the further things, of course, are, you know, our possessions. Most people don't really think they are their possessions, but when it comes to beliefs, a lot of us do identify with those. But as we identify further and further just with our consciousness, the witness, we're doing this the same as empathy, but in reverse, is what I show.
Yeah, and you talk about how empathy is related to understanding, and also that wisdom follows from understanding, which kind of gets us back to being open-minded and adopting different perspectives.
Yeah, so I think that understanding other people's perspectives is the real way to growth. It's very hard to develop our imagination without the help of other people. I mean, that's if we were just isolated in our room or whatever, we'd use our imagination, but it wouldn't necessarily develop to its full extent.
It's really interesting, the integration between the importance of relating and personal development. You know what? We have so much more we could explore, because this book is chock full of ideas, and it's really fun to read. But we've run out of time. And I want to be sure to tell our listeners about your website,
okay,
which is www.robertstonehill.com.
Right.
All one word, Robert Stonehill, and they can learn all about your book and the rest of your work at that website. Thank you very much, Robert, for being with us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
And for those who tuned in to the Pathway Show late, this is your host, Paul O'Brien, author of a new book coming out in September 2019 entitled Intuitive Intelligence, which shares the theme of pathways, personal and cultural evolution, and has quite a bit of overlap with Robert's book. In a second, I'll tell you how you can rewind and replay this interview whenever you want via the internet or as a free podcast. Today, we've been visiting with Robert Stonehill, author of Wise and Shine, Think Clearly, Live Deeply, Be Someone You Value. I want to say thank you to all of our listeners for tuning in to Pathways, which is broadcast and streamed on the internet at www.kboo.fm. Sunday mornings at 8:30 USA Pacific Time. Podcasts of today's show, which you can listen to and forward to others, are available for free at divination.com, spelled divination.com, as well as via iTunes and other free podcast servers. This is Paul O'Brien, reminding you to tell your friends about Pathways Radio and Podcasts. And thanks again to Robert Stonehill and to all of you listeners for tuning in and being a part of the Pathways conversation.